cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up a cloud he draw.
This is Dan Kinler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. As I've mentioned in the past, I very much enjoy Western stories that tell us about real people, actual events that have occurred. Often we read about such people or events in historical fiction, but even more so, I like hearing about real people and their recollections of what life was like. You may recall that we read a while back about Telluride, Colorado. We heard the reminiscences of people who had lived in the late 19th and early 20th century about that rough-and-ready Colorado mining town. Today we'll read something similar, although in a somewhat different vein. Our book today is entitled Hearts West, True Stories of Mail-Order Brides on the Frontier by Chris Enns, and that is spelled E-N-S-S. And this was published in 2005 by the Two Dot Publishing Company in Guilford, Connecticut, and Helena, Montana. We'll start by reading the foreword, then the introduction, and then I'll tell you a little about the author before we get into the heart of the book. And I'll remind you that some of what we read is edited slightly for recording. Foreword. The impact of women on the American frontier in the 19th and early 20th centuries should not be underestimated. To a large degree, women were responsible for taming the wilderness of the Wild West. Under their influence, churches were formed, schools and libraries were established, and the importance of home and hearth was rediscovered. The result was nothing short of a complete transformation, the conversion of the Western frontier from a rowdy, male-dominated society into a place that became a mecca for settlement, even after the gold rush and the promise of cheap land came to an end. During these early years of Western development, women often worked right alongside their men, turning the soil, planting the crops, and caring for the children who came along. It didn't take long for men who had traveled to far-off places west of the Mississippi to recognize that their desire and need of the gentler sex was profound. It is this desire and need that leads us now to the wonderful compilation before us. Hearts West reveals the real-life tales of women who became mail-order brides. Also presented are the stories of those enterprising few who attempted to make their fortune by bringing young women, spinsters, and widows to would-be husbands in the West. By the 1850s, so enticing was the call to riches that there were more eligible bachelors in the West than there were in the East. Some women, after answering a mail-order request, were taken out to the new land by their intended. Others traveled alone, over land or by sea. Many of the latter became seasick and would remain so for the length of the voyage. As we shall see in the unfolding set of stories brought together here for our enjoyment and education, not all of the matches were successful. All of them, however, contributed to the rich and colorful history of the West's early years. And that foreword is by Mary Ann Trigg, who is a branch librarian in Nevada City, California, and the proud granddaughter of a Dakota Territory pioneering family. Now the introduction, and it starts with a quote from Sarah Royce in Placerville, California, in 1852. Unmarried miners in these parts showed a consciousness of being somewhat the worse for a long, rough journey west, in which they had lived semi-barbarous lives, and for their continued separation from the amenities and refinements of home. The promise of boundless acres of land in the West lured hundreds of men away from farms, businesses, and homes in the eastern states as tales of early explorers and fur trappers filtered back from the frontier. Thousands more headed for California after hearing the siren call of gold. Tracts of timber in the Northwest and a farming paradise in the Willamette Valley of Oregon had even more people packing up and leaving home for the promised land. The vast acres and the trees and the gold were all there, and men set about carving their place in the wilderness. By the early 1850s, Western adventurers lifted their heads and looked around and realized one vital element was missing from the bountiful Western territories: women. A woman's track was discovered in the road leading to Mormon Island. The track of a woman was such a novel thing, the boys enclosed it with sticks. You know, women were scarce in California in those days. Sang, danced, telling yarns, and giving cheers to the women's track in the dust until a late hour in the evening, recalled Henry Bigler, third governor of California. Eliza Farnham, recognizing that she was no beauty, nevertheless was astonished to be the target of admiring eyes wherever she went in the gold country in 1849. Shocked at the dissolute lives of the largely male inhabitants of California, she conceived a plan to bring proper ladies to the West, which she saw as badly in need of the civilizing hand of woman. Her plan included a rigorous application process to guarantee only the most virtuous ladies would arrive on the good ship Angelique. The plan was widely publicized and endorsed by clergymen and officials. With anticipation running high, hundreds of angry bachelors nearly started a riot when just three ladies tiptoed down the gangplank in San Francisco. In Washington Territory, where men outnumbered women 9-1 in the 1850s and 1860s, a scheme to ship respectable women and families to the shores of Puget Sound was hatched by Asa Mercer. He raised money for the first trip, traveled to the eastern seaboard, and in 1864 brought his first shipload of marriageable women to Seattle. Only 11 women disembarked, leaving a lot of disillusioned bachelors. Mercer's second trip in 1866 netted a larger cargo of potential brides, but that trip was to be his last attempt at supplying a rather urgent demand. Newspapers editorialized about the lack of marriageable females. "We want an emigration of respectable females to California, of rosy-cheeked, down-east Yankee girls, of stout Hoosier and Badger lasses, who shall be wives to our farmers and mechanics, and mothers to a generation of Yankee Californians," opined the editor of the Alta California newspaper in 1851. The Matrimonial News, a San Francisco matchmaking newspaper, was dedicated to "promoting honorable matrimonial engagements and true conjugal facilities for men and women through personal advertisements," and was a forerunner of the matchmaking clubs and personal ads in newspapers today. Not all of the matrimonial bureaus and agencies were legitimate, however, and many a disappointed bride or groom was left with empty pockets after contracting for a mail-order mate. Mail-order bride Eleanor Pruitt, a widow from Arkansas, married Clyde Stewart after answering his ad in the News. The two were happily married for more than 20 years. Eleanor Berry was not as lucky. Her mail-order husband misrepresented himself in his letters, and the marriage lasted less than an hour. In Arizona, shootouts over the few eligible females led to the establishment of clubs devoted to arranging marriages. Six Tucson wives met in 1885 and formed the Busy Bee Club. Convinced that marriage would spread calm among the miners starved for the comforts of home, they met to recruit suitable women to marry the town's unruly bachelors. Some of the men were old enough to be the fathers or even grandfathers of the teenagers they selected as their brides. Once the vows were exchanged, these young women often took on a houseful of children as well as a husband. Hearts West contains the stories of men and women longing for the tie that binds, who risked everything in making an alliance with a virtual stranger. Some married well, some lost everything. Some, like Seattle's Mercer maids, became integral parts of the history of a specific region. Others may be anonymous, yet all deserve to be remembered for helping to civilize the rugged frontier. Now a bit about the author. Chris Enns is an award-winning screenwriter who has written for television, short subject films, live performances, and for the movies. She is the co-author, with Joanne Chartier, of the Globe Peacock Press's Love Untamed, True Romance Stories of the Old West, Gilded Girls, Women Entertainers of the Old West, and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, Women Patriots and Soldiers of the Old West, and The Cowboys and the Senorita, and Happy Trails with Howard Kazanjian. Her research and writing reveals the funny, touching, and tragic stories of historical and contemporary times. Enns has done everything from stand-up comedy to working as a stunt person at the old Tucson movie studio. She learned the basics of writing for film and television at the University of Arizona, and she is currently working with Return of the Jedi producer Howard Kazanjian on the movie version of The Cowboy and the Senorita, their biography of Western stars Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. Our first story is about Mary Richardson and Elkanah Walker, the missionaries, and it starts with excerpts from a couple of letters. Is it advisable for me to go out west without a companion? This is rather a delicate question to ask, but as I view it of such importance, it will plead its own apology. And that was from missionary Elkanah Walker's letter to the American Missions Board, March 16, 1837. You ought by all means to have a good, healthy, patient, well-informed, devotedly pious wife. There is a Mary Richardson of Baldwin, Maine, who has offered herself to the missionary board, but we cannot send her single. From her testimony, I should think her a good girl. If you have nobody in view, you might inquire about her. And that was American Missions Board Secretary William Armstrong's response to Elkanah Walker, March 20, 1837. A bright, blinding sunrise lit the small Richardson farm one April morning in Baldwin, Maine in 1837. Mary Richardson, the eldest daughter of the family, stood in the living room folding her father's discarded newspapers. Casting a glance out the front window, she squinted hard into the haze that was turning the valley into a trembling distortion of itself. A cloud mercifully drifted in front of the sun, and Mary could make out two riders approaching the house. She recognized one man to be a family friend, Dr. Lewis Whitney. The other rider was a stranger. Assuming the men were on their way to visit her father, the 26-year-old woman continued on with her housework. Moments later, her sister summoned her to the parlor to receive Dr. Whitney's companion, a lean, lanky gentleman who had come to call on her. Once pleasantries were exchanged, a letter of introduction was presented to Mary. As good fortune would have it, I have learned today of an opportunity to send a line near you at least by the bearer, Mr. Walker, and perhaps he will pass through Baldwin, in which case I have invited him to call at your father's on my account. If you receive this line, you will receive it as an introduction of the bearer, Mr. E. Walker, to your kind regards, as a suitor for your heart and hand. Should he thus present himself to you, the act will not be so hasty on his part as might at first seem. He has not been wholly unacquainted with you, though personally unknown. Friend and fellow missionary student, William Thayer, April 17, 1837. Mary looked up from Thayer's letter and smiled a guarded smile at the bashful man. He shifted uncomfortably in his seat as Mary continued reading. Elkanah Walker is a fine man and has been appointed by the American Board to go as a missionary to the Zula Mission in Southeast Africa. Of his disposition, without flattery or puffing, I number it among the kindest. Of his talents, I cannot predicate anything more than respectability. He is not brilliant, but he's exceedingly tormented with diffidence, and therefore his first appearance speaks less for him than after acquaintance would justify. In short, he is one of those men who must be known in order to be justly appreciated. As for his manners, look for yourself. If you can put up with somewhat of the uncultivated, if you can get by that obtrusive awkwardness, which he will no doubt lug in directly in front of him when paying his addresses to you, if you find nothing insufferable in these, I think you can love the man. But you must judge for yourself. A husband is a husband, notwithstanding he may be a missionary. William Thayer, April 17, 1837. Mary was moved by the sentiment in the letter, but knew she would need to know more about this suitor before she could fully pass judgment. Based on looks alone, Mary was unimpressed. She described him in her journal as being a tall and rather awkward gentleman. Elkanah stood at 6'4" and was quite self-conscious of his height. He was painfully shy and unassuming, so much so his friends said it was hard for him to even say amen at the end of his prayers. He was born on August 7, 1805, in North Yarmouth, Maine. He grew up on a farm, attended church regularly, and was the sixth child in a family of 10. From an early age, he aspired to be a pastor. He entered the ministry shortly after he turned 17. Elkanah and Mary shared a zeal for serving the Lord. Born on April 1, 1811, Mary knew by the age of 10 that she would become a missionary. Like Elkanah, she also came from a large family. She had 11 brothers and sisters. After excelling in all her subjects at school and graduating with high marks, she went on to attend seminary. Once her formal training in missions was complete, she applied to the American Missions Board for a position in the West, but because she was single, her request was denied. Mary was deeply distressed over these circumstances. She briefly contemplated a proposal of marriage from a neighboring farmer, but he was not interested in the missions. "Ought I bid adieu to all my cherished hopes and unite my destiny with that of a mere farmer, with little education and no refinement? In a word, shall I escape the horrors of perpetual celibacy, settle down with the vulgar? I cannot do it." Mary Richardson, May 1836. Dr. Whitney and Elkanah Walker's visit that spring morning was brief. The men made their goodbyes and left Mary alone to reflect on the meeting. That evening she recorded her thoughts in her journal. His remarks were good, but not delivered in a style the most energetic. After meeting, instead of shaking hands in a free, cordial kind of way, as I was anticipating, his attention seemed rather taken up in some other way. I saw nothing particularly interesting or disagreeable in the man, though I pretty much made up my mind that he was not a missionary, but rather an ordinary kind of unaspiring man who is anxious to be looking up a settlement. Mary Richardson, April 22, 1837. In spite of the uncomfortable first meeting, Elkanah dared to return to the Richardson home later that same evening with Reverend Noah Emerson, pastor of the local congregational church. The men were to attend a missions meeting in the area and stay over at the Richardsons' home. The following morning, Mary and Elkanah had occasion to sit and talk about their desire to be missionaries to the heathens. After discussing their lives and discovering they shared a mutual friend, Elkanah made his intentions known to Mary. "I suppose I am an accepted missionary," he told her. "As I have no one engaged to go with me on my journey, I have come with the intention of offering myself to you." Mary blushed, taken aback by his candor. Before she could respond to his bold declaration, her mother entered the room where the two were seated and invited them to join the other family members for breakfast prayer. Once the prayers were concluded, Mary excused herself from the others and returned to her room to think about the morning's events. The opportunity to serve the Lord as a missionary was appealing, but she questioned the wisdom of becoming engaged to a mere stranger. "The conflict was rather severe. The hand of Providence appeared so plain that I could not but feel that there was something like duty about it, and yet how to go to work to feel satisfied and love Him, I hardly know, but concluded the path of duty must prove the path of peace. I could discover a good foundation for true friendship." Mary Richardson, April 23, 1837. After much prayer and deliberation, Mary accepted Elkanah's proposal. During their short engagement, the two spent countless hours taking long walks and buggy rides and talking. They shared their dreams and stories of their pasts with one another, and, within a month's time, they had fallen in love. "His affection for me appears to be becoming very strong and somewhat enthusiastic, and I think I love him full well enough. We set up for the first time after 11, that is to say, until 1. At the close of our interview, he exclaimed, 'This is the happiest evening I have ever passed. I can be happy anywhere if my Mary is with me. I feel the angels are contemplating our conduct with pleasure. Mary Richardson, May 27, 1837. In June 1837, Elkanah said goodbye to his intended and traveled to Bangor, Maine to complete his seminary training. During their five-month absence from one another, they sent letters back and forth, outlining plans for their life after their wedding and expressing their affections. I love you, therefore I want you. If I could be with you this moment, a more heartfelt kiss you never had than I would bestow. To fold you in my arms, hear from your faithful lips that I am still your dearest one, would be sweet, sweet indeed. Elkanah Walker, August 18, 1837. On Tuesday, November 7, Elkanah appeared unexpectedly at the Richardsons' home. Mary was thrilled to see her fiancé, and after supper the two enjoyed a beautiful moonlit walk. His visit was short, but he promised they would be together soon and on to serving the Lord. Shortly after Christmas, Mary received a letter from Elkanah with news of their joint missionary assignment. She recorded her sentiments in her journal. The board wishes him to go beyond the Rocky Mountains. The proposal strikes me favorable. They wish to be ready to start in April. I hope we shall be able to go. Between letters, Elkanah had traveled to Independence, Missouri to purchase supplies and make preparations for their journey across the plains. From there, he wrote to inform his soon bride-to-be what she needed to pack for the trip. A change of clothes is all we want. Buckskin drawers are the best for riding on horseback. Our ladies should also have drawers to prevent being chafed in riding. We should carry no baggage excepting such as what we want to wear or use on the journey. All the baggage we carry will cost us $1 per pound. Elkanah Walker, December 18, 1837. The missionary board told Mary and Elkanah to be ready to leave for the West by March 20, 1838. The pair then decided to wed earlier than originally planned. They exchanged their vows on Monday, March 5, at 11 a.m., in front of a small audience of friends and family. It was a Richardson tradition that brides wore black during their wedding ceremonies to symbolize the grief over parting from their relatives. When Mary bid farewell to her parents that day, it was the last time she ever saw them alive. The newlyweds left Independence heading to Oregon on April 23, 1838. They were deeply devoted to one another and excited about the adventures that lay ahead of them. 4 months later, they reached the Shemakane Mission in Wyalatpu, Oregon. While en route to their new home, Mary gave birth to the first of their 7 children. The Walkers served as ministers to the Pacific Northwest Indians for more than 9 years. They left the area after natives attacked the mission and killed many of the missionaries living there. The couple relocated to Forest Grove, where Elkanah took a position as pastor for the local church. He later helped found the Tualatin Academy, which later became Pacific University. When Elkanah died in 1877, Mary missed her husband terribly and recorded thoughts about her loss in the journal she had started 5 years prior to their marriage. It seems as though I can't live without my husband. I feel so lonely. I think of so many things I want to tell Mr. Walker. I realize more and more how much more I loved him than anyone else. Mary Walker, December 18, 1877. Mary passed away 20 years after her beloved Elkanah. The relationship, which had begun in writing, endured for close to 4 decades. Now we will read Eleanor Berry and Louis Drybalbus, The Schoolmarm and the Scoundrel. This starts with a brief excerpt from San Francisco Magazine, April 12, 1873. Lonesome Meyer wants wife to share stake and prospects. Please respond to Louis Drybalbus in Grass Valley, California. Please come out, Eleanor. The frail voice of an elderly Ida Eigelberry pleaded from one side of a closed door. She knocked lightly, but urgently, on the frame. There was no answer. Ida turned the knob and gently pushed the door open. Her senses were immediately assaulted with chloroform fumes. Choking back violent coughs, she made her way to a still body on the other side of the suite. 22-year-old Eleanor Berry was face down on the mattress, with a handkerchief covering her head. The old woman quickly evaluated the desperate scene and panicked, racing out into the hallway. "Norman!" Ida called out to her husband. "Run and get the doctor! I'm afraid our Eleanor has gone and done something foolish!" According to the historical publication, The Californians, if Eleanor Berry had gotten her wish, she would have expired a month earlier, on July 27, 1873. She reasoned that if her life had ended on her wedding day, she might have escaped the degradation and heartbreak that was to come. But alas, God had not struck her dead, and now the deed was left to her. Eleanor's life began in the spring of 1851 in Gilroy, California. Her parents died when she was an infant, and so she was raised by her neighbors, the Eigelberries. She grew to be an attractive young lady, and chose to teach school as her profession. Still single at the age of 22, and fearing she always would be, Eleanor responded to an advertisement posted in a Bay Area literary journal. Louis Drybelbus, the author of the advertisement, was searching for a wife and was thrilled to receive Eleanor's letter in response to his ad. In the advertisement, Louis described himself as a wealthy, average-looking man eager to settle down. Letters between the two went back and forth from Eleanor's home in Gilroy to Louis's in Grass Valley. The pair corresponded for 3 months. She was quite taken with his candor and his praise of her desire to work with children. "Such a woman will make a fine mother," he wrote. Louis found Eleanor's letters to be intelligent and sincere in tone. It did not take long for the mutual attraction to evolve into affection. Louis's letter of proposal was met with enthusiastic acceptance, and the couple decided on a wedding date of July 27, 1873. After resigning her position as Gilroy's schoolmistress, Eleanor packed her trunk and boarded an eastbound train to meet Louis for the first time and to marry him. Eleanor fanned herself with a newspaper as she took her seat on the train. The temperature inside the Central Pacific passenger car was oppressive, hotter even than the 95 degrees outside the train. She was accompanied by several passengers making their way to the mining camps near Grass Valley in Nevada County. Once the train reached Colfax, the bride-to-be and her belongings were transferred to a 6-horse stagecoach. Of the 13 passengers on board, Eleanor was the only woman. The stage driver promised Eleanor and the other passengers a safe trip and tried to assure them that they would not be overtaken by highwaymen, men who robbed travelers on public roads. Given the cargo, the driver no doubt needed to reassure himself of that notion as well. Nestled between the trunks and suitcases was a safe containing $7,000 in gold that was to be deposited into a Grass Valley bank. The trip was relatively uneventful for the first leg of the journey. According to one newspaper account, the passengers passed the time on the 8-hour journey swapping stories about the places they had lived or visited. Eleanor contributed to the conversation as well, creating brilliant remarks and witty banter with other passengers. The men admired her vivacity and charm. During lulls in the conversation, Eleanor daydreamed about her upcoming nuptials and life thereafter. She removed a few of Louis's letters from her handbag and reread them. She smiled to herself, imagining she and her betrothed standing at the altar, looking into one another's eyes, and seeing all the possibilities to come. The coach's abrupt stop brought her back to the present, tossing her on the floor in the stagecoach. A gruff voice outside the buggy demanded the passengers step out with their hands in the air. She exchanged anxious glances with her wide-eyed travel companions as they reluctantly did as they were told. 4 armed men, wearing gunny sack masks over their heads, shouted at the passengers. The bandits eyed their victims carefully. For a moment, no one made a move. Then the driver lowered his arms a bit, and a highwayman with a six-shooter pulled the hammer back on his gun. The driver's arms shot back up. "We'll take your treasure box," the man with the six-shooter demanded. "It's on the other stage," the driver insisted. The bandit snickered. "Then we'll keep you here until the other stage comes around," he warned. The driver studied the dress of the bandits for a quick moment. Their feet were encased in gunny sacks and tied in place at the ankle, a trick professionals used so no visible footprints would be left for a posse to follow. The driver realized these were ruthless desperados who would make good on their threats, and he finally relented. "It's no use fooling any longer," he said. "This is the only stage tonight." The man with the six-shooter snickered again. "That's what we thought." A bandit carrying a shotgun aimed the barrel of the weapon at the driver's head and motioned for him to move away from the stage. The two other thieves instructed the passengers to do the same. After lining the travelers up against a nearby fence, the gunman climbed on top of the stage and headed for the strongbox attached to the coach. Several attempts were made to break into the safe with a pick, but to no avail. The thieves decided to blow the lock with gunpowder. Eleanor looked on in horror as one of the men hauled a small canister of gunpowder from his saddlebag on the stage. The strongbox was in proximity to the passengers' luggage. An explosion would destroy the trunks and all of their belongings. "Stop!" Eleanor yelled. The men halted their work to listen to the prospective bride. "Gentlemen, my trousseau is in my trunk. Won't you take it down before you blow up the coach?" The thief with the six-shooter stood up and backed away from the safe. "With pleasure, miss," he replied. Eleanor walked over to the stage as the robber chief jumped off and motioned for the gunman near the safe to toss her trunk down. As he reached up to take hold of the trunk, Eleanor noticed a long, jagged scar on the back of the man's hand. She filed the image away in her mind and was pleased at the sight of her possessions being returned to her. The highwayman turned away and went about his business. Kaboom! Seconds after the robbers lit the fuse on the canister of gunpowder, a fierce explosion ripped through the stagecoach. The thieves wasted no time searching through the rubble to find the gold. After securing their ill-gotten gain in their saddlebags, the leader hopped on the back of his horse. "Come on!" he yelled to his cohorts. Following suit, the gunmen leapt onto their rides, and all four hurried off into the trees, disappearing from sight. The shaken driver inspected the damage to his coach and determined that the frame of the stage and the running gear were still intact. The spooked horses were settled and readied to continue the journey to Grass Valley. The passengers found their places on the shattered coach, and they were off. Upon their arrival in Nevada City, the crime was quickly reported to authorities, and police officers immediately set out to apprehend the culprits. The stage then proceeded on to its appointed destination, first depositing Eleanor at the cottage of her betrothed. Louis Drybelbus's landlady greeted the exhausted bride and informed her that her fiancé had been called out of town but would return shortly. The kind woman escorted Eleanor into a room where she could prepare for the wedding. The bride-to-be washed away the dust and dirt from her travels with a bath the landlady drew for her. Afterward, she dressed in her most elegant attire, pinned up her hair, and made up her face. "It's time, dear," the landlady said as she burst into the bedroom. Eleanor quickly stood up, smoothed down her dress, and checked her look in the mirror. The next time she saw her reflection, she would be Mrs. Louis Drybelbus. Eleanor entered the parlor smiling nervously. There were two men sitting off to one side, a minister and a witness. Opposite the pair, Louis stood dressed in his Sunday best. The pair sized each other up for the first time. He looked considerably older than she expected, but there was a strength of character in his face that she always imagined her husband would have. Louis, on the other hand, was taken aback for a moment, almost as if he was surprised to see her. He covered his response with a slight smile, before drinking in the petite, agreeable features of his fiancée. The minister took his place in front of a fireplace, and the bride and groom made their way toward him. The minister happily opened the Bible he was holding and began the proceedings. As the couple recited their vows to one another, Eleanor paused between pledges to think. Lewis's voice sounded strangely familiar. "We'd been corresponding for months," she told herself. "Perhaps what I recognize is the echo of the idea of him in my head." The minister pronounced the two man and wife, and Lewis timidly leaned in to kiss his spouse. Their embrace was brief and awkward. The minister rescued them from the tense moment by escorting the newlyweds to a table to sign the marriage license. Eleanor took the pen in hand and placed her name in the appropriate area. Lewis followed suit once she passed him the pen. As he signed his name, the light from the flames in the fireplace reflected off his hand, revealing a long, jagged scar. Eleanor knew in an instant where she'd seen the mark before. The color drained from her face and she screamed. She hurried out of the parlor and locked herself in her assigned quarters. Lewis looked on, stunned, not knowing what to say or do. Of course, he had recognized Eleanor as the young woman on the stage he robbed earlier, but he could not imagine that she had recognized him. He raced out of the home, mounted his horse, and rode off into the night, saying nothing to the landlady, minister, or witness when he left. The landlady pressed her ear to the bedroom door and listened for a sound on the other side. Eleanor was crying, too ashamed to face anyone and wishing she would simply expire. She remained holed up in the room until the next morning. The unfortunate bride stepped into the parlor the next day, her face wet with tears. The minister and landlady greeted her with apologies and words of comfort. Eleanor looked at them confused. "Mr. Drybelbus and I never married," she told her compassionate new friends. "I have no memory of a wedding, only a dream that in the night I was carried off by robbers." The minister and the landlady exchanged worried glances, assuming that the shock from the previous day's events had left her disoriented. "I've changed my mind about taking Mr. Drybelbus as my husband," she told the pair before her. "He's not as well fixed as I expected to find him." After packing her trunk and soliciting a ride to the stage stop from the minister, Eleanor was on her way back to her home in Gilroy. Nevada County Sheriff's deputies caught up with Lewis Drybelbus more than 2 months after the wedding. He confessed to the crime, turned state's evidence, testifying against his fellow bandits, and was subsequently released without charge. The detective who initially located Lewis bought him a one-way ticket to Lewis's hometown in Illinois and warned the robber against ever returning to California. Eleanor slipped into Gilroy under the cover of darkness. She was too embarrassed and ashamed to admit to her friends and neighbors that she had married a thief. For anyone who dared ask what happened, she maintained that her mail-order groom had not been what she expected. But eventually, the truth of the ordeal became public knowledge, and Eleanor was the topic of conversation. Humiliated beyond words, the young woman decided to commit suicide. The distraught mail-order bride's life was saved by the fast action of her guardian and by local doctors. It's not known what became of Eleanor after she was revived and brought back to health. Historians speculate that her broken heart mended and that true love eventually made her forget her first trip to the altar. Now we shall read Asa Mercer, Bride Entrepreneur. And this starts with a short piece from the Seattle Gazette of 1864. "It is to the efforts of Mr. Mercer, joined with the wishes of the darlings themselves, that the 11 accomplished and beautiful young ladies whose arrival was recently announced have been added to our population." In the February 24, 1860 edition of the Puget Sound Herald, an advertisement was published that testified to a serious shortage of a desired commodity in Washington Territory. "Attention, bachelors! believing that our only chance for the realization of the benefits and early attainment of matrimonial alliances depends on the arrival in our midst of a number of the fair sex from the Atlantic states, and that, to bring about such an arrival, a united effort and action are called for on our part. We respectfully request a full attendance of all eligible and sincerely desirous bachelors of this community assemble on Tuesday evening next, February 28, in Dellum and Shorey's building, to devise means to secure this much-needed and desirable emigration to our shores. Signed by 9 leading citizens, the advertisement was picked up by other newspapers and reprinted across the country. Some of the resulting stories were humorous, but the wide coverage achieved the intent of the authors in broadcasting their need. They had hopes of attracting industrious young women to the rich and rugged Northwest, where a few thousand young men were working on making fortunes in timber, fishing, farming, and other endeavors. The lonely bachelors held several more meetings, but no solid plan to import the desired commodity was formulated, and few suitable women emigrated in response to the advertisement. The pioneers in Washington Territory had, by 1860, established prosperous communities along Puget Sound, and were busy carving out farms and ranches along the coast and towards the foothills of the Cascades. The temperate climate, rich fisheries, and timber resources provided the raw materials upon which to build a comfortable life. The one serious deficiency in this Western Eden was that the fair daughters of Eve, as one newspaper editor described women, were scarce. The topic had occupied many column inches in newspapers for several years. There's probably no community in the Union of a like number of inhabitants in which so large a proportion are bachelors. We have no spinsters, wrote the editor of the Puget Sound Herald. He went on to say that the prosperous and clean-living young men populating the area in 1858 were eager to put their necks in the matrimonial noose. In 1860, Asa Shin Mercer hit upon a scheme to take the next step in the recruitment effort. He would import the desired commodity by traveling to the East Coast, where women were in abundance, and actively promoting the unequaled advantages of Washington Territory. That idea and its sequel were part of the fascinating career of A.S. Mercer, who found his own bride among those he recruited for Washington Territory. Fresh from college when he followed his older brother, popular Seattle pioneer Judge Thomas Mercer, to the Northwest, Asa slipped right into place in the ambitious new town. Asa worked enthusiastically to help erect the college, and he became a teacher at the Territorial University when it opened in 1861. He also served as the unofficial acting president when the first man recruited turned down the job, and he helped to recruit new students who could afford to pay the fees, which became part of his compensation. The lack of marriageable women had become a serious detriment to progress. What good was a university if there were no wives to produce the sons to populate its halls? Seeing an unfulfilled need, Asa rushed to the rescue. He solicited private contributions to make a trip to the East Coast and raised enough money to go to New England in 1863, with the hope of bringing back several hundred suitable ladies. Unfortunately, a special committee had been appointed by the Massachusetts legislature to investigate the excess of females over males in that state, amounting, according to the census of 1860, to 37,515. The committee had examined the state's needs for laborers and manufacturing businesses. Fearing that the end of the Civil War would see textile mills reopening, the report discouraged any project from sending the surplus female patient to such western states as have an excess of males. Asa hoped to attract hundreds of people, mostly marriageable women, but he was doomed to disappointment. As a result of his efforts, 11 unattached women paid $225 for passage and boarded the SS Illinois when it headed out to sea in the spring of 1864 on that maiden voyage. The women were welcomed to Seattle, and all but two found husbands. Lizzie Ordway, who never married, was devoted to teaching and eventually became a county school superintendent. Another of the young ladies died, apparently of heart trouble. Capitalizing on the buzz generated by his success, small though it was, Asa ran for a seat on the territory's governing council. In May 1864, the Seattle Gazette enthusiastically endorsed his candidacy. "Mr. Mercer is the Union candidate for joint councilman for King and Kitsap counties, and all such bachelors, young and old, may, on election day, have an opportunity of expressing, through the ballot box, their appreciation of his devotedness to the cause of the Union, matrimonial as well as national." He won the seat and served in the Territorial Legislative Assembly through January 1865. Then, he undertook another recruiting expedition to the East. "One of the most enthusiastic supporters of my contemplated raid on the widows and orphans of the East, as he was wont to call it, was Governor William Pickering," Asa later recalled. "The day before I started for New York, the governor met me, shook my hand warmly, and said, 'God bless you, Mercer, and make your undertaking a great success. If you get into financial trouble and need money, do not hesitate to wire me, and I will give you help.'" A few months after arriving, Asa sent a letter to the folks back home from Lowell, Massachusetts. It was printed in the Gazette and announced, "The 19th of August, I sail from New York with upwards of 300 war orphans, daughters of those brave, heroic sons of liberty, whose lives were given as offerings to appease the angry god of battle on many a plain and field in our recent war, to perpetuate freedom and her institutions." Asa asked the citizens of Seattle to prepare and house and care for the young ladies. He vouched for their intelligence and moral character. The papers reprinted his letter, and communities immediately appointed welcoming committees, though some were dismayed at the number of women headed for their shores. While the welcoming committees back home were meeting, Asa was running into rough waters. The New York Times endorsed the plan to ship widows and orphans to the new territory, and that sent would-be emigrants to Asa's door. But others sounded dire warnings that Asa was a procurer for the dens of iniquity in the West, and cautioned that those who left the safety of their families and their communities would suffer unmentionable fates. Newspapers weighed in on the topic all across the country. "The surplus sweetness of Massachusetts spinsterhood would be wasted in Washington Territory," opined the La Crosse Democrat. The editorial continued, "Dr. Mercer has arrived in Boston and perfected arrangements to return at once with a cargo of Bay State virgins in black stockings, candlewick garters, shirtwaists, spit curls, green specks, false teeth, and a thirst for chewing gum." Meanwhile, a famous female lecturer, Anna Dickinson, made biting remarks about the scheme, pointing out the odd logic involved in bringing school teachers to Washington Territory when it was common knowledge that the northern regions were populated largely by single men. "How your Washington bachelors can be fathers is a subject rather for a hearty guffaw than for any serious debate," Dickinson pointed out in an article reprinted in the Alta California. Her lectures in New England during the fall and winter of 1865 were widely attended and given a good deal of press coverage, which may have reduced the number of people interested in emigrating. While the newspapers capitalized on the sensational aspects of the plan, Asa's capital was shrinking at an alarming rate. As Seattle historian Clarence Begley later reported, he was ever prone to take whatever he urgently hoped for as certain of accomplishment. Asa's urgently hoped-for voyage with hundreds of accomplished young women and families, however, was almost stopped on the docks of New York. The ship that Asa said was to have been made available by the federal government ended up in the hands of another schemer, who demanded a large sum to carry each of the passengers. The money he'd been given by young bachelors to cover costs of bringing back wives was long gone. Funds provided by others to be used for various investments had also been spent. The delays, the loss of the ship, and finally, the negative publicity, caused caused many of the young ladies and their families to cancel plans to join the expedition. 5 months late, and several hundred ladies short, the SS Continental steamed out of New York Harbor January 16, 1866. Roger Conant, a New York reporter who traveled with the party, reported on the voyage. "The departure was marred," says Conant, whose account was supported by several passengers, "when some of those who had been promised passage were sent back before the ship left the harbor." Conant's version of events, as related in his journal, tells of an old man with 5 children being escorted off the ship when he could not pay the passage. The man's money had been used to cover hotel costs during the long delay. Conant described the departure as though it were a theatrical farce. "The disappointed virgin screamed, 'Mr. Mercer! Mr. Mercer!' The gray-haired man hoarsely shouted, 'Mr. Mercer! Mr. Mercer!' But no Mr. Mercer answered their appeals, and a thorough search of all the staterooms failed to discover his place of concealment. Finally, the ticketless would-be emigrants were escorted from the ship, and the Continental edged out of the harbor. Where was the hero of the day? Mercer was hiding in the coal bin. Conant describes the removal of the hatch cover once the ship was underway. "A heavy, lumbering tread from below heralded the approach of the great benefactor of the virgin race. Soon a shock of red hair, besprinkled with coal dust, bearing a strong resemblance to a zebra's skin, appeared below the opening. Then a pair of red eyes lifted themselves to the light, and soon a pair of hands were thrown upward in an appealing manner." Mercer was lifted from his hiding place by a couple of sailors. Flora Engel, who was 15 at the time, and traveling with her mother and brother to join her father and sister in Seattle, later wrote a long account of the voyage. Both Conant and Flora said that Mercer paid court to one young lady, but was rebuffed. "Mr. Mercer, who'd formed a second attachment, and had been so fortunate as to have his passion reciprocated, married Miss Annie Stevens of Baltimore," Flora reported. "Annie's father owned a hat factory in Philadelphia. She and Asa were the same age, 26. And though she was Catholic and he was Methodist, they were married in Seattle in July 1866. The ship arrived in San Francisco Bay on April 24, 1866. Some of the passengers, apparently daunted by dismal descriptions of the Pacific Northwest, decided to stay in sunny California. Obligated to pay the fare to Seattle for his remaining passengers, but with only a few dollars in his pocket, Asa sent an urgent request for money to the governor. He later recalled, "I spent $2.50 sending him a telegram. Quote, 'Arrived here broke. Send $2,000 quick to get parted to Seattle.' The next day I received a notice from the telegraph office to call, pay $7.50, and receive a dispatch waiting for me. Having but 50 cents, I could not buy the message." He went to the telegraph office, explained his penniless state to the superintendent, and suggested the man open the dispatch to see if it contained an order for money, which would allow him to pay. He opened the envelope and read, and then burst into a hearty laugh, then handed the message to me. It was made up of over 100 words of congratulation, but never a word about money. 36 passengers left the ship and stayed in California, but the rest took voyage on various ships heading to Seattle, where, according to Flora Pearson, Seattle housewives received them with open arms and vied with one another in entertaining the newcomers in their humble homes. And the men, well, they would fain open their arms also had they dared to do so. As it was, there was standing room only at some of the windows. The Mercer maids, as they came to be called, found husbands and jobs in Washington, Oregon, and California. Only a few returned to the eastern seaboard. Asa, with his Irish bride behind him, embarked on a series of promotional and career adventures that sent them from place to place all over the West. He authored a 40-page pamphlet, "The Washington Territory, the Great Northwest, Her Material Resources, and Claims to Emigration," which was the first of many tracts promoting the Northwest. Relocating to Oregon, he became a customs collector in Astoria, where he was accused of smuggling. The matter was eventually discharged following unsuccessful attempts to prosecute the case. He then became involved in shipping and real estate. It was in Oregon that he again displayed his knack for promotion and began writing for newspapers. By the 1880s, Asa, Annie, and their children were living in Texas, where he found and edited several publications. Moving to Wyoming, he started the Northwestern Livestock Journal and was involved with the Wyoming Stock Growers Association. Annie died in 1900. She had given birth to 8 children, 3 of whom died in infancy, and 1 as a teenager. She'd followed her husband from place to place, never complaining publicly about his enthusiastic promotions and the failures and public criticism that seemed to follow almost everything he did. Asa died at his home in the Bighorn Mountains in 1917. Though his schemes and dreams may have been bigger than the means to properly carry them out, his activities add a richly colored thread to the tapestry of Western history. And thus we conclude this section of Hearts West, True Stories of Mail-Order Brides on the Frontier, by Chris Enns. Thank you for joining us for Western Short Stories. This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
That old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plow through the ragged sky, and up the cloudy draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.